True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. This episode was suggested to us by Jean, who's a longtime listener. In fact, Jean was so enthusiastic about this case that she volunteered to write the script, and we certainly took her up on that. Jean was a federal prosecutor in the San Francisco Bay Area for 27 years, focusing primarily on white-collar crimes before she retired in 2018. Jean looks forward to the U.S. Department of Justice becoming a nonpartisan institution once again, and cherishes the career attorneys who stuck it out. So thank you for all your research and hard work, Jean. This is a fascinating case you brought to our attention, and we're excited to share it with our listeners at The Quiet End.
Sure. That said, please join us at The Quiet End for The Cards He Was Dealt, the story of the life and death of Barry Crane. Barry was born Barry Cohen, November 10, 1927. He was a dynamic force from a relatively young age. He entered television during its fledgling years and shaped what our grandparents and parents, and perhaps even some of us, watched religiously from the mid-1950s through the mid-1980s. An accomplishment in itself, Barry was one of the best bridge players in the history of contract bridge. So he was a really gifted man.
He certainly was. When we discuss his television career, I think people will be pretty impressed.
So on July 5th, 1985, Barry was murdered. His death lay on the books of the LAPD for over 30 years, until just on May 9th, 2019, his alleged killer was arrested. So join us at The Quiet End. We're going to discuss the life of Barry Crane, his murder, and now the prosecution of his alleged killer. So what have you got for a beer today, Dick?
I have a beer called Sculpin, which is some kind of fish, right? It's an IPA. It's brewed by Ballast Point Brewing Company in San Diego. It's an American IPA, 7% alcohol by volume. This beer's a pretty-looking beer. It's a copper-orange color, thick white head, a little bit of lace. Very good aroma, citrus, and sort of this bready malt. Nice taste of orange, tangerine, grapefruit, and maybe surprisingly some crusty French bread. This is a fairly complex mouthfeel because you get the individual tastes all kind of coming together. And I found this is one of the best IPAs you'll ever drink when it's fresh. IPAs tend to not deteriorate, but they're not as lively with some age on them. So you want to get this within a week or two of being canned or bottled. That's the way to go. It's an excellent beer.
All right, let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, come on over, Dickie, and start this story.
We'll be at the quiet end again.
That's right.
So Barry Crane was born Barry Cohen on November 10th, 1927, to Sylvia and Lou Cohen. The oldest of two children, Barry and his brother lived with their parents in Detroit. Now, Barry's father, Lou, was an accomplished man in his own right. Working with his brother, Ben, they operated luxurious theaters that showed the newest talkies and booked the hottest musical acts. The Cohen brothers operated theaters from the height of the Roaring Twenties through the 1940s. They lived in an exciting city during exciting times. Let me read you a passage from the historicdetroit.com, which provides a great feel for those times. Everybody, it seemed, wanted to get into the theater business. This was the boom period for Detroit movie houses, and between 1925 and 1928, the city added more than 23,000 seats in a half-dozen large theaters. Among these movie moguls were brothers Ben and Lou Cohen, who operated a slew of theaters in Detroit, including the Capitol, Paradise, Mayfair, Rio, Roxy, and Norwood. The brothers were born in Toronto, but grew up in Detroit. Ben Cohen was the first to get involved in the movie biz, leaving school in 1909 to open his first movie house. His brother soon teamed up with him, and they formed Detroit Theatrical Enterprises, Incorporated. In 1917, the brothers took over their first theater together, the Colonial, which they operated until 1931.
Yes, so there's no doubt the Cohen brothers were ambitious. In 1926, they constructed the Hollywood Theater. Designed by a well-known architect, it was intended to make a statement. This single-screen theater cost $2 million to build, which would be about $26 million in today's money. It would be a monument to entertainment and a theater that will compare very favorably with, if not outshine, any other community theater in America, the Detroit News reported. So once Detroiters bought their tickets, they'd step into this soaring 60-foot-high lobby. An enormous wrought iron chandelier dangled above them, and curving marble staircases flanked either side of the entrance to the auditorium. So these palatial interiors were topped off with marble walls and gilded plasterwork. In keeping with this European atmosphere, guests were greeted by ticket sellers draped in Spanish shawls and doormen and ushers in uniforms laced with black and red. So after they found their seats, patrons would find experts have so arranged the auditorium from orchestra to uppermost balcony seats that every patron had a perfect vision for both the stage and the screen attractions. So they went all out.
They did. I mean, it's just, if you're used to going to theaters these days, it's nothing. This one, the 3,436-seat Hollywood, was the second largest when it debuted. Only the 4,038-seat Michigan Theater was larger.
So this was like just a whole evening out, right? It was a whole thing, not just the feature itself, but being there.
It was an event.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And I think it's obvious, but they didn't just show films. It was live entertainment, other performances. It was very posh, very big time. So the Hollywood had been built to compete with the big boys, and it was as opulent as it was gargantuan. Velvet curtains, mirrored niches, and ceilings were covered with large medallions drizzled with gold and shimmering silver. The room was capped by a dome ceiling that soared about 100 feet above the crowd. The walls were largely cut stone. It was simply one of the most beautiful, most comfortable theaters in the universe.
So the brothers were profiled by the Kansas City Star. They had really shattered tradition by hiring women to manage their theaters. So these men of business acumen took a chance and they won. For not only was their judgment justified by the results, but the women selected for these positions far excelled the men who had previously run the theaters. Over the next decade, the Cohen brothers operated the Lincoln Square Theater, the Colonial Theater, the Roxy, the Mayfair, the Rio, and the New Paradise Hall, all in or nearby Detroit. The theaters featured first-run films such as Kid Comes Back, which was a prize-fighting film, and Start Cheering, a musical comedy starring Jimmy Durante with a cameo by the Three Stooges. Also, Bowery at Midnight, a horror film starring Bela Lugosi at the Paradise. Mr. Ace, a film noir starring George Raft at the Roxy. And I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now, a musical starring June Haver. Also, On the Old Spanish Trail, which was a western starring Roy Rogers and Trigger at the Rio. Well, and most of these actors, a lot of people probably haven't heard of them, but these were really big actors back then.
Yeah, I think most of them are known. Well, certainly Roy Rogers and Trigger.
Sure, but I think most people under 40 probably haven't heard of most of these things.
No, I'll give you that. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Right. So Lou was this well-rounded man with varied interests, one of which was the card game bridge, and he taught it to his children. He continued to operate his theaters, play bridge, and work on civic projects until he died in 1947 at the age of 53. So Barry was only 20 years old when his dad died. There's little information on him before that time. He attended the University of Michigan for the 1945-1946 school year, but did not return after his father died. He married his first wife, Arlene Anderson, in 1944. And this marriage didn't last. So in 1946, Barry married Shirley Coblin. He had two children with Shirley, Sherilyn and Ben, a boy and a girl.
While raising his family, Barry was building a name for himself in the bridge world. In 1952, when he was, 25 years old, pretty young, he won the prestigious McKenney Trophy. The McKenney is the big deal in bridge. It was named after American Contract Bridge League Executive Secretary William McKinney. It's awarded to the player in North America who accumulates the most master points in tournament play in a calendar year. So like I said, he was 25 when he won it for the first time. This victory was the beginning of kind of a symbiotic bond between Barry and the McKinney. For the next three decades, he dominated the field. He either contended or won pretty much every year, 30 years. It's an amazing run.
It really is. But while he did become increasingly successful with bridge, the second marriage was failing. In 1954, he was divorced for the second time, and then in 1955, he decided to move to Los Angeles. And that's when things really changed for him. In American mythology, Barry's move west to the Great Frontier was a reinvention of himself. Barry was not thriving in his old life, and he really felt like he was at a turning point. Two divorces already, two children to support. He didn't finish college. He had the skill at bridge and knowledge about himself that was just not public. So he needed to make a change, and he did. He made radical changes. He changed his name from Barry Cohen to Barry Crane, and he moved to L.A., leaving his children behind, also his mother and brother. So he began to express himself honestly at this point as a gay man. Even though he was closeted, he did have more freedom than he'd had before. And I just can't imagine how difficult it would be to be gay in those years.
Yeah, even in a place like Los Angeles.
Sure.
You would tend to think would be a little more enlightened.
Well, a little more, but not a lot more.
Oh, no.
No.
Not in those days.
So information about Barry's lifestyle is scant. He was good at deflecting questions about his personal life. During an interview in 1972, he explained, "I was married twice, but both marriages ended in divorce. I can't relax. In February, I went on what was supposed to be a 3-week vacation in the Caribbean, but I could only stand it for 5 days. My mind is overactive." But he was very creative.
He certainly was. Barry's approach to his sexuality was in keeping with the times. He was discreet. He lived by the maxim of don't ask, don't tell. In a 2017 article, Michael Bertsold explained that though his contemporaries in bridge and in Hollywood knew he was gay, he wasn't vocally so. There were still sodomy laws and police harassment. Then prejudices were compounded in the 1980s with the arrival of the AIDS epidemic. People were afraid of infection, and many gay men were treated as though they were toxic.
Oh, for sure. They were just cut out of society.
Yes, they were.
So Barry had been 28 years old when he moved to L.A., and he'd immediately gone to work in the entertainment industry. He clearly had some advantage coming from his family's background, but it's not known if he needed or used that advantage. He shopped an original screenplay that became part of a 3-picture deal between RKO and King Brothers. The script was titled The Seven Lanterns of Japan, described as the asphalt jungle with a Japanese setting. The Asphalt Jungle is a 1950 film, noir, directed by John Huston, pretty well known.
Very famous.
So the film was never made, but it did allow Barry to get his foot in the door.
Yeah, and while he did use this script to get wrapped into a film deal, Barry really spent his entire career in Hollywood and television. 1955, when Barry arrived, TV was in its infancy. Only about 20% of the homes in the United States had a television set. Now, Barry started as an assistant director on several television series. The assistant director is the person who tracks the daily progress of the actual filming against the filming production schedule. The assistant director also arranges logistics, such as finding shooting locations. He prepares the daily schedule, checks on the cast and crew, and maintains order on the set.
Well, at the time, Westerns and private detective series were really the mainstay of television. Barry worked on Richard Diamond, Private Detective, starring Dick Powell, and Dick Powell's Zane Grey Theater, a Western anthology series that often featured Dick Powell. Also Wanted, Dead or Alive, which was another Western. By the late 1950s, Barry had advanced to production manager. A production manager works with the producer and other staff to choose the script, draw up the budget, and hire the crew and equipment. Also, books the shooting locations and during filming, make sure the production runs on schedule as well as on budget. So Barry worked as production manager on several TV series, including Johnny Ringo, which was a Western, and Peter Loves Mary. And this was some married entertainers who leave New York City for life in the small town. That Dick Powell Theater show, the anthology of comedies and dramas, also had stars like Ronald Reagan, Lee Marvin, Milton Berle, and Mickey Rooney. And The Rogues starred David Niven, Charles Boyer, and Gig Young as a trio of former con men who could, if the price was right, be persuaded to trick wealthy and unscrupulous marks, so kind of con men.
Exactly. Barry was particularly good at sussing out film locations. He traveled a lot and was always on the lookout for a good location. Despite its size, Barry had almost an encyclopedic knowledge of Southern California, so he could find places anywhere. Barry was good at his job. He created lifelong professional connections that eventually led him to work on some of the most influential television shows of the 60s and 70s. According to David Gerber, a producer who worked with Crane, when you gave him a script, you felt good about it because he was a very conscientious man. He'd work on each script and make it very much better.
So one of Barry's connections created his opportunity of a lifetime. Barry worked with Bruce Geller on several of Dick Powell's series. And when Lucille Ball's production company agreed to produce a series created by Geller, he brought Barry along as the production manager. And that TV series became very successful. It was called Mission Impossible. And that's what all the Tom Cruise movies, I don't know, are there five or six of them?
There's several, yeah.
Were loosely based on that show.
We all know that one, right? Your
I
mission,
think so.
Should you choose to accept it?
Sure, if you don't know the old show, you know the movies, I would think.
Yeah.
But Barry worked on Mission Impossible from its launch in 1966 until the series ended in 1973. He worked on 145 episodes, either producing, directing, or writing, also advancing many innovative ideas to both the script and the evolving technology. During his time at Mission Impossible, Barry transitioned from a production manager to assistant producer and then to producer. Producer is one of the most prestigious positions in television, coordinating and supervising just all aspects of a production. So Barry's love of bridge extended into his weekday job, and he often played bridge with Peter Graves between takes. Peter Graves was one of the actors in the show.
He's the boss.
Okay.
He's also in Airplane.
Right, yeah.
Maybe people remember him from that. But yeah, he was the head man of the Mission Impossible team. So while producing Mission Impossible, Geller also created and produced Mannix, a weekly detective series that ran from 1967 to 1975. Geller brought Barry in as the associate producer from 1969 to 1972. And, like he did with Peter Graves, between takes, Barry played bridge with Mike Connors, who was the star of Mannix. Now, when Mission Impossible and Mannix came to an end, Barry directed episodes of several well-known series of the 70s. Here's a few of them. $6 Million Man, The Bionic Woman, Hawaii 5-0, Dallas, Chips, The Incredible Hulk, and Trapper John M.D. I think even the youngsters are going to recognize these names.
At least some of them, yeah. During the early 80s, he directed episodes of popular TV shows, including Flamingo Road, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, The Powers of Matthew Starr, and he also directed a movie, Conquest of the Earth, the third and final chapter of the Battlestar Galactica trilogy. But throughout this career in television, Barry played bridge on his weekends. He would leave Friday night, play in a tournament Saturday and Sunday, and return Monday morning. At the time of his death, Barry was considered the best match point player of all time.
The game of bridge evolved from the 17th century card game of whist, and in 1925, a small group of players fixed the basic rules of contract bridge. So it's a trick-taking game using a standard 52-card deck, no jokers. It's played by four players in two competing partnerships with players sitting across each other around a table. Each player is dealt 13 cards, then the auction phase begins. Based on the cards in their hand, each player bids. They bid to identify the trump suit, which is the suit that will beat the other suits, and to specify how many tricks, or wins, the partnership that wins the auction will make. During the auction, partners exchange information about their hands, and there's ways of bidding that allow you to do that. Person who bids the highest number of tricks wins the auction. That person is called the declarer. By winning the auction, the declarer's team has created a contract to win the number of tricks they bid. In a celebrated 1931 incident, Myrtle Bennett, wife of a Kansas City perfume salesman named John Bennett, became so irate when her husband failed to make a four-spade contract that she bolted from the table, grabbed a pistol, and shot him dead. That'll teach him.
So they took this seriously.
This is a serious game.
Well, and there was money involved. So Barry just loved the bridge world, actually thrived in it. His game was described as diabolical, daring, and decisive. Barry won more than 1,000 tournament championships, some 700 of which were pairs titles at the regional or higher level. He won 7 U.S. National Open pairs titles, 3 Master Mixed Teams titles, and 3 Mixed Pairs titles.
In 1951, when Barry was just 23, his team finished second in the Vanderbilt knockout teams, and he became an American Contract Bridge League Life Master number 325. In 1978, he and his partner Kerry Sanborn won the World Mixed Pairs title at the 1978 World Championships in New Orleans.
Well, Kerry Sanborn was apparently one of Barry's favorite partners, a force in the game. She was the last woman to win the McKinney Trophy in 1974. So she was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2007. Sanborn joined Barry's team during a 1969 tournament when she was a newcomer. Her newbie status didn't matter to Barry. They got along well because, as Kerry said, "I don't make the same mistake twice." And she also said playing with him was like a magic carpet ride. So good, I guess that means.
They teamed well together. Barry was clearly a force at tournaments, and to be that good, a player must have a certain set of skills, and Barry had a whole basket of them. He could act brilliantly under intense pressure, he loved the game, and he had an almost magical understanding of the cards. He did have style. People could not be around him for very long without forming a strong opinion. Grant Bays, who was a great bridge player himself, was not a fan. He described Barry as volatile, mean, narcissistic, vindictive, and petty. Pretty much says it all, huh?
Yeah. So after winning his first McKinney Trophy in 1952, he won that title 5 other times. Just doing the math shows the influence Barry wielded over the McKinney race. Barry competed for 30 years, so that's 30 opportunities to win the McKinney. He won first or second place 10 out of the 30 times, while playing against a field of thousands of players.
To win the McKinney, Barry entered tournaments throughout the United States. Whenever he entered a tournament, it was a news story. Barry was considered an A1 ambassador and publicist for bridge all over North America. No one gave as many interviews to the media in as many different cities and towns. Barry's abilities, his personality, his quirky, and his passion created the equivalent of a 1970s rock star. And he loved that treatment.
Well, that's hard to believe.
Yeah. Well,
it's in certain circles.
Those bridge players are pretty racy.
I guess so.
So, and his influence over the McKinney was legendary. Grant Bays described Barry as the kingmaker, and Barry clearly took this title seriously. Ken Mozingo, a bridge player who sat on several tournament boards, believed that Barry could capture that race just about any time he chose. But his busy television work caused him even more wins. There was an unwritten rule that if you wanted to win the McKinney, you have to show respect by asking permission from Barry.
Wow.
And include him on some of your teams.
That sounds a little psychotic.
Well, it sounds like he's taking it to his head a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was common in those days for very wealthy clients to hire 4 or 5 of the country's best, play lots of team bridge, and then win that trophy.
Barry's influence over the annual McKinney race was never more apparent than in 1981, which is just a few years before his murder. While professional players had been part of tournament play for some time, the bridge world was beginning to see wealthy players using their money to win tournaments. Now, you could argue that that person would also have to be a pretty good bridge player. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter how much money was being spent.
Yeah, but if you have the money to hire the best teammates, then you definitely have this huge advantage with them.
You certainly would. But I think, again, you got to be a pretty good player yourself. You can't just be throwing the money around.
Well, sure.
So Mel Skolnick entered the tournament world during this time. Mel had been a force in business for over a decade. And by 1981, he had made a fortune in real estate, and he could afford to compete in bridge at a top level. One player said that Skolnick was a, quote, non-bridge player, unquote, who said, I'm going to show the bridge players that I can outperform them, no matter how much it costs me. So this 1981 race was one of the bitterest dogfights in the history of contract bridge. Skolnick employed former McKinney winners Soloway and Anderson to oversee the operation. The full list of Skolnick's army was formidable indeed, including world champions and a host of other leading American players. Skolnick himself believed he was thumbing his nose at the elitism and snobism that pervaded bridge.
Well, sure, he could thumb his nose at elitism by hiring these top guns, but he did make an error in strategy. He didn't include Barry in the fun.
Yeah, and remember, Barry had to be consulted.
He's the rock star of bridge.
Right, and he had to be able to give his permission.
So a player remembers that for the first part of the year, Barry was directing TV shows, so he called Mel in May and said, I'm ready to start playing with you. And Mel told him he had all of his arrangements already, but he later said, I didn't put enough sugar on it. So Barry was furious and really hell-bent on beating Mel in this McKinney race. So it kind of backfired.
It did. And Skolnick suffered for this. So Barry decided, I'm going to enter every tournament I can. He started the season late, so he had a lot of catching up to do. But he continued to win and place in tournaments, and he accrued more and more points. Both men attended any event that offered points up. This caused quite a stir in the bridge community. This was the race of a lifetime, and the excitement was infectious.
So by the end of the year, the race was close. But Barry was behind. So the McKinney would be decided at the last tournament of the year, and Barry had a good chance of winning. At the tournament, Skolnick's team won a knockout event, but Barry did much better by winning two pairs championships and finishing second in another. So before the start of the concluding event, Barry trailed Skolnick by 41 points, and for him to snatch an incredible last-minute victory, he needed to win the event, and Skolnick had to play badly. But he did play badly. Still, though, Barry didn't win. So Skolnick won the McKinney Trophy, collecting almost 2,500 master points, which was the second highest total ever, and Barry finished behind, having broken his own personal best. So he wasn't happy.
He wasn't, but he played really well. Now, after the 1981 season, Barry continued to play in tournaments on a regular basis, but his work schedule prohibited him from making a successful run at the McKinney. He was busy directing episodes of Chipped and Trapper John M.D., but regardless, he continued to dominate the bridge scene. He finished third in the McKinney in 1983 and second in 1984, so he might be cutting back a little bit. He is still a force.
So it was July 4th, 1985, and Barry was in Pasadena competing in the Bridge Week Regional Tournament. Barry was part of a four-person team poised to win this tournament. He'd also played a two-session pair game with Billy Miller, who was a Silver Life Master and Bridge Bulletin columnist. So at the end of the day, Barry invited Miller and his ex-wife to dinner at a restaurant nearby. They drove with Barry in his car, but when they got to the restaurant, Barry excused himself, saying he wasn't feeling well. But before he left, Barry was seen making a call on the phone there.
Yeah, the next day, July 5th, Barry's team was ready, but he wasn't there. They were waiting for him to arrive. His absence created an immediate murmur amongst the players because his team was right there ready to win the tournament. He wouldn't not show up. Where was he? While the players at the tournament were waiting for Barry, his housekeeper arrived at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to clean his townhouse in Studio City. The housekeeper entered the front door on the second level and noticed a trail of blood on the stairs leading to the bedroom on the third floor. She followed the trail, but Barry wasn't in the bedroom.
Now, would you follow the trail?
No.
Not like it's her husband or something.
I'd be calling the police.
She goes in there, she sees a trail of blood, and she goes upstairs. That's just not too smart.
Nope.
You don't know what's going on up there.
The bedroom certainly contained signs of a struggle. There was a large, bloody ceramic vase lying on the floor. There was blood on the floor. Bedding was missing from the bed.
Yet the housekeeper persisted.
Yep. So she followed at this blood trail back down the stairs to the street-level garage. And there she found Barry, or Barry's body, nude and wrapped in sheets.
So the police found no sign of forced entry or of the house being ransacked. The only missing items they could identify were Barry's wallet and his Cadillac. So based on the blood stains, police believed Barry was killed in his bedroom, and then his body was dragged down to the garage. The bloody ceramic vase did look like it had been the murder weapon, because he'd been bludgeoned. So according to the LAPD, there was no readily apparent motive for Barry's killing. I don't know, I think stealing a wallet and a car could be motive.
Sure.
So right. I don't know why they didn't think that was a good enough motive.
I know.
But they didn't know who did it. That's the problem.
No. And while police were investigating the crime scene, word spread among the players in the bridge tournament. Barry Crane was dead. The shock of this information was palpable. And his absence created a problem because his team was short a member.
Well, God, I think that's the least of your worries. He's been murdered.
Yeah, but game's got to go on.
These people are into their bridge, yeah.
So many top-level players volunteered to fill in. And his friend Kerry Sanborn was selected. Then when Barry's team won the tournament, the room burst into applause.
Huh. But then police detectives came to the tournament. Dennis Sorensen, an accomplished bridge player, was at the tournament when the detectives showed up, and he described the investigation as quite exhaustive. He said those of us who had ridden in Barry's car provided forensic evidence, which included hair, fingerprints, and blood work. I was told close to 100 people were part of this evidence sample. Of course, no DNA at this point. This is a long time ago.
1985, yeah.
So a few days later, on July 8th, the LA Times reported that detectives continued their investigation Sunday into the Studio City bludgeoning murder of television director and bridge expert Barry Crane. They interviewed bridge players and tournament officials who knew him. They said they didn't have a lot of clues, but that's all they would say. They declined to give any details of the investigation, which is normal. You don't want to give things away when you're trying to find the suspect.
No, you don't.
But not long after, the LA County Coroner's Office completed Barry's autopsy, and they concluded, not surprisingly, that he had died from blunt force trauma to his head, and they were also going to do toxicology tests.
Then on July 10th, Barry's Cadillac was found along a road in Los Padres National Park, west of the town of Gorman on Interstate 5. It was about 60 miles from Barry's home. Now, not disclosed at the time, but eventually reported, police did collect some items of evidence from Barry's car. These included fingerprints, cigarette butts, blood samples, and Barry's gas credit card. So the L.A. District Attorney's Office reported that Barry had been killed after being bludgeoned with a ceramic statue and then choked with a phone cord.
So it really kind of shows maybe some rage.
It does.
Either rage or like some crazy drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where public reports about Barry Crane's death pretty much came to an end. By 1986, news of the investigation just kind of faded out. There was no word from the LAPD on the status of the investigation and no reports from the media. So you have to wonder, was this because he was a gay man?
Uh-huh.
Wasn't treated as seriously. Just like the AIDS epidemic, that was set aside a long time because it was mostly affecting gay men.
Exactly. This is kind of puzzling for the Barry Crane case.
Sure.
I mean, he was a really gifted man and was well known in multiple circles.
And quite wealthy, I would imagine.
He did all right. Now, on the day he died, Barry had over 35,000 master's points in bridge, which is 11,000 more than anyone else. But he was considered the game's Babe Ruth. Groupies even followed him from city to city to watch him play. And in the entertainment industry, Barry worked with dozens of famous people who had financial resources. Yet there was no advocate for Barry. No anniversary articles or billboards or rewards for information. Barry's murder became a closed case very quickly.
So I'm imagining he was kind of estranged from his children? That's what I'm picking up here.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, but I certainly get that undercurrent.
They weren't close, at least.
No.
No. So he really didn't have family members, you know, pushing the police to do an investigation, which really can make a difference, as we've seen in many cases.
Right.
So the lack of progress kind of created a vacuum. Since the killer wasn't found, theories about the murder were just everywhere. Of course, no member of the Bridge World believed that he was killed by one of them, and they couldn't find a reason. There were some rumors and claims that Barry owed money in Las Vegas to some mob people, or that his son owed debts in Las Vegas, and that he was about to disown his children. But really, none of these theories held up. Barry was well off. He didn't need to borrow money from the mob. And if he did, mob hits don't use ceramic lamps as the murder weapon. So it didn't look like a professional hit at all.
No.
Also, his children lived in the eastern U.S., and there was no evidence to support any theory that would implicate them, like they killed their father for money. So really, the crime scene told the only story they knew. No sign of forced entry, no robbery. Barry was killed in his bedroom. He was found naked underneath the sheets that kind of served like a shroud. His car, clearly the means of escape for the killer, was found 60 miles away. So whether the LAPD or the television industry or even the Bridge World wanted to acknowledge this or not, these were all signs of a crime of passion, right? He was naked, he was in the bedroom, and it seemed like it wasn't a planned killing if you're picking up a vase and whacking someone with
it. Right, and then strangling him with a telephone cord.
Exactly.
So those are kind of like spur-of-the-moment things.
So what they're really not saying, but they're probably thinking, is it was a gay lover.
Probably.
I think they were thinking that might have been it. The investigation, though, was not transparent, so we don't know exactly what they did. Dick, why are you smashing your headphones to bits?
I am just so frustrated listening to ads. Why can't I listen to my favorite podcast without those annoying ads?
Well, I can't help you with other podcasts. However, True Crime Brewery now comes commercial-free for our TieGrabber members.
Huh?
That's right. If you subscribe at any level, you get to listen to all of our new episodes commercial-free. And this is in addition to our bonus episodes each month. Plus, you get some great TCB swag mailed to you when you join.
At least I can listen to True Crime Brewery ad-free. I really wish other podcasts would do that. And Jill?
Yeah?
Do you know where the glue is? I just pounded up my last pair of headphones.
We know it's easy to second-guess any criminal investigation. Only the investigators know the evidence and the possible leads. But investigators are like anyone else. They have limited resources and they have to prioritize their cases. This wasn't the only murder in LA. So they follow leads and they tried to dig up some others, but there was always a nuance that guided the cases that were worked the hardest. In the investigation of Barry's death, a thread really runs through interviews by police of Barry's colleagues that might point to the real reason the investigation had stalled.
Yeah, and here we come probably to the crux of the matter.
Exactly.
Investigating the death of a gay man in the mid-1980s likely faced more complications. As reported by Michael Betzold in DeadlineDetroit.com in 2017, Crane was a closeted gay man in an era where, even for famous people like him, coming out was problematic. Once Barry was killed, his sexuality would no longer be closeted. Detectives would investigate his life, and the secrets of his sexuality might become public. His reputation would be damaged, and by extension, anyone or anything, for example, Bridge, might also be damaged.
That's a horrible way to think. Don't like it. Well, but, that kind of thinking was prevalent. It's just the way things were, unfortunately. So at least there's one way that we've made improvements in the world, I feel like.
Yeah, in that same article by Betzold, he wrote that, conscious of Crane's legacy and name on the ACBL's most prestigious trophy, The general counsel for the Bridge League said, "We don't need to dig up old dirt that might damage Barry's reputation." And it was very likely that not only Barry's reputation would be affected, but the bridge people's reputation.
Really?
That's what they're worried about.
That seems stupid.
Yeah.
Well, granted, statements made by the lawyer for the ACBL are not any indicator of the investigator's approach, but in the same story by Betzold, LAPD Detective Thomas Townsend said pretty much the same thing. So here's the problem with this way of thinking. If you don't dig up old dirt, you're not properly investigating the crime, right?
You are.
Obviously.
Right.
I mean, dirt leads to evidence. In the 1980s, it was still very shameful to be gay, if not criminal. So compound this shame with the theory that Barry was brutally murdered by a male lover. This line of inquiry really made people uncomfortable. So how much of these feelings, sometimes called bias or prejudice, affected the investigation may never be known. Sometimes, though, investigators wait for technology to improve rather than do the legwork, which seems really lazy, and then you still have a killer out there. So it's certainly not the best way to handle things.
It is not.
But like I said, it's positive that time has passed and attitudes have changed. And also the technology for the investigation, of course, improved. So nothing really happened for, what, 20 years?
At least 20 years, yeah, in 2006. And then more importantly, in 2018, LAPD detective from the Robbery Homicide Division requested that evidence, including fingerprints, be retested. Because in early May 2018, a fingerprint specialist contacted that detective to tell him that there is a new forensic technique that might allow them to extract fingerprints from the steering wheel of Barry's Cadillac. And they did that. So in early July, the specialist was able to match one of the fingerprints to set on the automated fingerprint identifying system. The prints belonged to a 51-year-old man named Edwin Hyatt. This is like, who? The police tracked Hyatt through Facebook and Verizon to North Carolina. And then they asked the FBI to keep him under surveillance.
Yeah, the FBI set up really a very extensive surveillance operation, and they watched Hyatt live his life in Connolly Springs, North Carolina, a small town about 50 miles northwest of Charlotte. It's named after William Lewis Connolly, who was a captain in the North American State Militia. His regiment participated in the relocation of the Cherokee people in the journey that we know as the Trail of Tears. But today, Connolly Springs is a small town. Just about 1,700 people live there. Hyatt worked at a place called Second Chance Auto Repair Shop. And while under surveillance, he tossed cigarette butts and also a disposable coffee cup into the parking lot. So these were able to be collected.
Yeah, so the cigarette butts and the coffee cup collected from Hyatt were processed to create his DNA profile. And then cigarette butts found in Barry's car after his murder were used to create a DNA profile of the killer. Then on January 14th, 2019, it was announced that the two samples matched.
So that's kind of miraculous. I would think that they'd given up.
I am just amazed.
Yeah.
I mean, not only that they still had those cigarette butts, but they were able to get DNA off of them.
Right, right.
I mean, that's just amazing.
It is. Less than 2 months later, LAPD detectives traveled to North Carolina and interviewed him. Now, I don't know why they waited that long. I don't know why they just didn't go and arrest him at that point. But according to the LAPD press release, he had now admitted to killing Barry Crane. So it'll be interesting to see and hear what Hyatt said to the LAPD detectives, because when he was led into court, he told reporters a totally different story. He told the local TV station that he didn't remember Crane's name until it was told to him, and he had no memory of what had occurred so long ago, except for bits and pieces that were brought back to me just by suggestion.
Yeah, he said, "I don't remember anything, y'all. I wish I could remember. A lot of things may have happened, just little bits and pieces. I don't have too much information. I don't know any more than y'all know. I do recall there was times I was taking drugs."
So is he saying there he could have killed him, but doesn't remember it?
It's possible. He might have been into drugs at the time, and just his memory didn't work for him.
Yeah, but this wasn't someone who was not in his right mind at all. There was an effort to hide things.
Right.
But he didn't recognize Barry from the picture he was shown. He said he lived a different life today and thanked God for the miracles he's given me. So he's saying he's a changed man, which would not absolve him of murder, of course.
No, it would not. The public record of Edwin Hyatt's life starts when he was arrested for the murder of Barry Crane. Now, at the time Barry was murdered, he was 57 years old and Hyatt was 18. So that also lends some credence to Barry picking him up for companionship.
Was he a gay man, Hyatt?
We're not told specifically.
But he never admitted to having sex with Barry.
He can't remember.
Okay. And there's a lot we still don't know.
No, there isn't.
Well, after Barry's murder, Hyatt seems to have spent most of his life as kind of a drifter. He was caught with a stolen car in Utah in 1985. In 1997, Hyatt was arrested when he beat his former wife. He actually choked her until she vomited, and then he threatened to burn her house down. So, super nice guy. That was when Hyatt's fingerprints were put into the system. In 2013, Hyatt ended up in Connolly Springs, and he worked for Turning Leaf Tree Service until he had an accident. And in 2014, he started volunteering at the Oak Sweeten Creek Assisted Living Center.
Yeah, and at some point, Hyatt became a born-again Christian, which is a kind of a classic way to mitigate one's guilt for a very bad act.
Well, yes.
He became active in church life in North Carolina after settling down there, and he went about his life pretty quietly until he was arrested in 2019.
Well, I have to think that he does remember doing it. I don't buy that line. So I'm thinking he must have thought he'd gotten away with it. It's been years and years. Must have been quite a shock for him.
It must have been. Because you certainly would remember that you killed somebody.
Absolutely. When word of Hyatt's arrest spread, his neighbors and coworkers were quite shocked because he was this kind of nice neighbor next door. No one suspected him of being a bad guy. A coworker named Dee Hall believed that Hyatt was a generous and peaceful man who wouldn't hurt anybody, not even a flea. Another person who knew Hyatt, Ernest Ward, remembers that when he first saw him, he was actually known as the guy that carried the cross across the country. He drug the cross for a long time, and I seen him going up the road with the cross. He said, he helps an awful lot of people. He cares about a lot of people. He does things in the name of Jesus. He believes wholeheartedly in it. He would tell me about his past and drugs and drinking and stuff like that, and how he was so thankful that God delivered him from all that. He said that Hyatt was a nice character. And that might be true at this point, but he certainly had some demons in his past.
Yes, he does. And he might have shared some of that story with some of the townspeople.
What story?
That he killed somebody.
Okay. I thought they all thought he was a good guy.
Well, let me tell you a couple other things. First, Mr. Ward said, I think very highly of him. I'll let you know that. I care about him as a person here. It's important to me that he needs to have some kind of somebody here to represent him that says, hey, look, I'm here whether you did right, wrong, or indifferent. Now, Dee Hall believed that it was self-defense.
Okay, based on nothing.
Based on what Edwin has said to them.
I guess.
We're not at liberty to say what happened. We don't know exactly just what little bit Ed has said to us in the past. But that's his place. That's his story to tell, not ours. So, see, that's why I was talking about he probably confided to some people. Maybe kind of an oblique reference, but they knew that there was something in his past.
Well, yeah. I mean, I certainly think they knew about the drugs and stuff. I don't know so much about the murder or about the homosexuality. Or if he even was a homosexual or if he was just getting picked up to get drug money. Didn't care who picked him up, you know?
Yeah.
But the many testimonials for Hyatt, you know, kind of showed that he really did change. Of course, it isn't clear how long any of these people have known him, and it also hasn't been made public what, if any, other crimes he may have committed, because it's always hard for me to believe that this was only one violent crime in a person's life. And we do know that he beat up a wife, so he does have a history of violence.
Right, and he stole a car.
Right.
Besides Barry's, he stole another car.
Sure, but I mean, that's not violence. The violence is the murder.
Right. and the strangling or choking.
Yeah. So his criminal record shows that the murder of Barry Crane didn't scare him straight because he stole that second car, and we know that he beat at least one other person.
Yeah, and certainly humans are complicated beings. The rule of law, though, keeps things simple. If a person ends the life of another, they must face a jury of their peers. Forgiveness is what comes after.
So the L.A. County District Attorney's Office filed the case against Hyatt in May of 2019, and then they issued a statement a few days later announcing they had charged him with one count of murder with a special allegation that he used a deadly and dangerous weapon, which was the heavy decorative object, during the commission of the crime. So, of course, if convicted, he faces life in prison without parole.
Yeah, after his arrest in Connolly Springs, Hyatt appeared in court for his initial appearance arraignment on May 9, 2019. So, as with every criminal case, the court must determine whether Hyatt is the person identified in the charging document. He didn't deny who he was. So after the court made sure he understood the charges against him, he was remanded to jail while law enforcement worked out the logistics to extradite him to California. So this order, the extradition order, was entered on August 15, 2019. And on October 8, 2019, he made his first appearance in a Los Angeles court where he pled not guilty.
Yeah, so Hyatt has appeared before the court several times since then. In March of 2020, he was sent for a mental competency evaluation pursuant to California Penal Code 1368. So either the defendant's attorney or the judge may question the defendant's mental competency, according to PC 1368. The judge can declare the need for a determination based on his or her interactions with the defendant in court. Hyatt's next appearance is slated to occur at the end of the year, but because he's under psychological evaluation, no trial date has been set.
So for 30 years, Barry Crane produced and directed television shows that millions of people watched every week. He was involved in directing, producing, or writing in approximately 681 television episodes. And if you don't have enough of a list, here's some other shows that he was involved in. Wonder Woman, Police Story, Kung Fu, Streets of San Francisco, and Eight is Enough.
I remember Eight is Enough.
There you go. And this doesn't even begin to identify all the television shows where Barry was involved.
No, the one that really stuck out to me, something that I watched as a child, was The Love Boat. Saturday night, we had The Love Boat and Fantasy Island, and my girlfriends and I were really excited to watch those every week.
Can't go wrong.
Do you want to sing The Love Boat song for us here, just to give us a little taste of it?
No, I'll pass. Thank you.
Well, Dick, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't address the whole atmosphere for gay men in Los Angeles back then. Actually, the entire U.S. In 1985, the year Barry was killed, more people were diagnosed with AIDS than in previous years combined. And when AIDS became known in the U.S., it was really looked at by some of the religious right as God's punishment against gay men.
Now, you might laugh and think how stupid, but that's true.
It is true. I remember it. I'm old enough. I remember that quite well. And like homosexuality itself, the straight world just didn't want to think about AIDS because they didn't think it was their problem.
That's correct. The virus first hit in regions of Central Africa, and after it moved into North America, it became a global pandemic. HIV is believed to have killed a young man in St. Louis in 1969. Now we know that a Norwegian sailor died from AIDS in 1976, after he'd been traveling to Africa.
Yeah, in the late 1970s, the HIV strain that started the North American pandemic had entered the U.S. via Zaire and Haiti. By then, the sexual revolution was still going strong, and HIV began to spread pretty silently at first among gay men in the larger American cities. So men who have sex with men were, and still are, disproportionately infected with HIV. And that's because it transmits more easily through anal sex than through vaginal sex. But that's not to say it doesn't get transmitted through vaginal sex.
Oh, absolutely. So after the Stonewall riots in 1969, LGBTQ activists made some significant civil rights advances and actually secured some protections against discrimination in public employment in some states. Over 20 states had decriminalized sodomy by 1980, and some activists were already talking about the next frontier, legal recognition for marriage. Now, HIV stopped progress for LGBTQ rights and raised prejudice and fear of homosexuals.
Oh, absolutely. When the HIV cases first showed up in Los Angeles, the LGBTQ civil rights movement really suffered a backlash. And this was headed up by just wonderful people like Anita Bryant and Reverend Jerry Falwell. Their so-called moral majority pushed against civil rights for gay people, which to me is just evil.
Yes, it is. Now, before we continue on with this, let me just mention there's an excellent book on AIDS and HIV epidemic written by Randy Schiltz called The Band Played On.
Yes.
A fascinating book.
It was actually made into like a mini-series on, I think, HBO a few years back as well. Imagine being a gay man back then and all your friends are dying and nobody cares.
Yeah.
It's awful. In 1980, evangelical Christian leaders presented a petition to President Jimmy Carter demanding a halt to the advance of gay rights. As the anti-gay reaction spread across the country with the election of moral majority ally Ronald Reagan, activists found that their demands for attention for HIV as a growing medical crisis were pretty much ignored.
Well, Reagan denied actually that it even existed.
Yes. More than a dozen states repealed sodomy bans in the 1970s, and just two jurisdictions decriminalized sodomy in the 80s. So really, the tide had turned against them, if it had ever not been.
Yeah, right.
According to an October 2018 article that I read from NBC News, Ronald Reagan's press secretary, Larry Speaks, actually laughed when he was asked whether the president was tracking the spread of AIDS in the country. That was in 1982. And it really wasn't until 1985 when Reagan publicly even said the word AIDS. And that was when over 12,000 Americans had died, and now they were realizing that the virus was spreading through hemophiliac populations and also injection drug users. So it wasn't just the gay guys anymore, so he thought he'd give it some attention at that point.
And another person who is significant at this time was Dr. Tony Fauci, who we are all familiar with right now with the coronavirus.
Yes.
He was significant in evaluating and working on the HIV virus.
Absolutely. And we don't have a vaccine for AIDS. There is some really good treatments now, though. You can live with AIDS.
But yeah, there's no treatments because the virus mutates itself easily. So they were, at least so far, have not been able to make an effective vaccine.
Yeah, so through his life, Barry Crane did not see the disease recognized as anything but a gay plague. So he wasn't alive to see a lot of the LGBTQ rights make progress. And he died still basically living in the closet. Being gay in the 80s meant really being isolated from his true identity. As a TV producer, he had to be acutely aware that there were no gay characters in his TV shows. And no men on TV ever hugged or held hands or kissed each other. Even if the censors had allowed it, the network stations and their viewers would have reacted negatively. There would have been instant cancellation of shows, boycotts, and lost advertisers. And those were headed up by people like Anita Bryant and televangelists. So it's just a sad way to live your life.
Oh, it really is.
Especially you're someone who's working hard, who's skilled and talented, and you can't really be appreciated the way that you should be. So it's just sad that people lived like that, and of course many people still do.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate thing.
It certainly is, yeah.
Because even with all the advances, there's still a significant number of people who view it as some kind of sin or disease or there's something wrong with you.
Absolutely, but I certainly think in my lifetime there have been some positive changes.
Oh, there have been, yes.
And, you know, that's because of a lot of activists that gave their lives and worked hard to change it.
Correct.
Yep. In the bridge world, Barry Crane is an enduring legacy. From 1968 until 6 years after he died, 23 years, he led the world in Master Point rankings. Fittingly, after his death, the McKinney Trophy was renamed the Barry Crane Top 500, so that's nice. And he was inducted into the ACBL Hall of Fame in 1995.
So let's end with one player's memory of Barry. It's an honor to be remembered by your opponents after the battles are done and the campfire lit. I still have the newspaper cutting from the LA Times concerning Barry's death and my winning some other event. I was with Lyle Peake the day after. We were having coffee, and Lyle was sewing a black rhinestone armband to wear in honor of Barry. We lost the rhinestone cowboy way too early. He was of a gentle heart.
So there were some people who appreciated and loved him.
That's nice.
It is nice. So the sources for this case are just numerous. Gene put a lot of work into this.
I tell you.
So I'll try and share those in the show notes, but I'm not going to list them now. There are too many. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you enjoy our show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. And before we get into feedback, I just want to remind you about the TCB merch. We've got Christmas coming right up, so if you're looking for a gift or a stocking stuffer, you can check out our TCB store at tiegrabber.com. The hoodies are very popular, and I would recommend those, because it's getting chilly out, and they're very nice. I like the lightweight one. Also, we're in partnership with TeePublic, so the prices are really very reasonable and good quality. I mean, everyone in our house has one of these sweatshirts, and we love them. So Dick has some feedback for us. What have you got, Dick?
I have some emails today. I got three emails. I couldn't talk anybody into leaving us a voicemail.
Yeah, we're waiting for those. But you know, they come in bunches,
they
get a bunch, then we play a couple of them, and then we wait, and then we get a bunch a few weeks later. So
yeah, we get clumps.
We do, but the emails are always coming in. So you go ahead and read our first case suggestion from Sandy.
This is from Sandy. She says, if you haven't done it before, I'd like to recommend the case of the murder of Miriam Illis in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, in January of 1999. Her husband, Richard, was a well-known and very skilled cardiothoracic physician in our area. I was working at the hospital at the time, and although it took 4 long years for the case to be proven, from the beginning, everyone in the county thought he was the killer. There are many good beers produced here in Pennsylvania, and some right here in Williamsport. I do love your podcast, but would humbly suggest you have a professional write your commercials.
Sandy!
Cheers, Sandy. I guess she's referring to our commercial about the ads.
Right, the subscribing as a tie grabber and getting ad-free episodes.
Yeah.
Which are purposely hokey.
Yeah, we certainly, if we wanted a polished ad, we would have a professional write it.
Yes, we're well aware they're not polished.
But intentionally so.
Well, it's the best we can do too, but yes.
Yeah, so on the night of January 15th, 1999, Miriam Illis was talking on the phone with a friend. There was a shot fired through a window, pierced her heart, and killed her pretty much instantly. And this was a difficult, convoluted case that took 4 years to solve. And Sandy's already told us that we know who the guilty party is.
Yeah, you know, we have seen either 48 Hours or a Dateline on this case. I'm a little bit familiar with it. And he does seem guilty as sin. So yeah, that's a great suggestion. I will definitely add that to my list of to-dos.
Thank you.
Yeah. So then we have a case suggestion from Kim. She says, my name's Kim, and I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. The case I think about often is Fred Lane, who was killed by his wife, Deirdre. Fred was a former Carolina Panther. Is that a basketball or a football?
Football.
At the time of his death, I believe he had signed with the Indianapolis Colts. They were divorcing and she had given birth to their daughter. He came to the home to get some items and she said that he tried to attack her. The investigation also showed where Deirdre and her brother had been involved with bank robberies and just stealing with a bank employee. She and her brother, I believe, had been coddled by their parents. Neither one had jobs but were living luxury lifestyles. I know that she's out now, but I'm not sure about her brother. She tried to work at a children's day camp, and people were not happy. I know that Mr. Lane, Fred's father, was very involved with the case. I haven't heard anything about him since she was sentenced. Her parents ended up raising her children, so I hope you'll look into this. He was popular here, and he may have been on the team when Ray Carruth was. And that's someone that we did a case about, right?
We've done that, where he killed his pregnant girlfriend.
That's right, yep.
I think that he was about that same time. I think maybe Carruth was a little bit earlier.
So this was July 2000. Fred Lane was shot to death by his wife as he entered their home. He was shot in the chest and in the back of his head. So Deirdre claimed that she was a battered wife. She pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and was sentenced to just 7 years, 10 months of jail time.
Yeah, she's been out for over 10 years.
That's crazy. She shot him twice. I don't know about that. I don't buy it.
Back of the head.
Not buying it.
Well, that's how that worked.
All right. So we'll look into that because, like I said, I don't like Deirdre's story.
No. So we got one more from Amy. Amy lives in New Zealand, so I really thought that'd be a good one to look into since we haven't done any New Zealand cases that I can recall.
Sure, yeah.
So there's this case in New Zealand which is close to my heart as it involves a girl I went to school with. She was a year older than me. I didn't know her as such, but I am friends with people who were good friends with her during high school. No one has ever been charged, and to be honest, the police never really had a dead set case against the suspects. They were her father, her brother, and her boyfriend. Now, the latter, I feel, never really got looked into enough. The father, unfortunately, passed a few years back. There was so much speculation around him. He changed his story numerous times. He claimed he'd hit his head and forgotten stuff. And there's some funny things about his vehicle, if I remember rightly. So the deceased's name is Christy Bentley. She is 15 years old, and she went missing on New Year's Eve, 1998.
Just a kid.
She's taking her dog for a walk down by the Ashburton riverbed and was never seen alive again. Her dog was found the following day tied to a tree, not far from where she set off, with clean clothes placed with the dog. So dodgy, right?
Absolutely
it is. Has to be someone who knew her.
Yep.
Her body was found, I think, about a month later, decomposed in another riverbed 40 kilometers away. By some unsuspecting young chaps who were checking their dope crops. She is chopped up from what I can gather, and they had to identify her from dental records. So it's fascinating. This case is probably the most famous unsolved murder case in the history of New Zealand.
Okay, so definitely another one to look into. I'm interested in all three of those.
See, we got some good cases.
We do. Thank you, everyone, for your feedback. Thanks again to Jean for sharing this case with us. And you know what? We'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll save a seat for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.